I don't know if you remember, it's kind of old now, but the newspaper comic strip Calvin and Hobbes. You remember that with the little boy who was about 6 or 7 years old, and he always got into trouble with his imaginary stuffed tiger who he named Hobbes. And they used to have all sorts of adventures. And my favorite strip really had no punchline. It had no punchline at all, really. But it was the one where they were playing a game called Calvin Ball. And I love Calvin Ball because the whole point of Calvin Ball is it's a game that the two friends had invented and played themselves. And it was played with croquet mallets and croquet wickets. And it was played with a volleyball, and you had to have, wear a mask around your head, and you had to play with the little birdies from badminton, and all that kind of stuff. And the rules were like impossible to follow. And the only rule in Calvin Ball, the only rule to follow, is that all rules are made up. I love that game. That's just such an awesome game. And there's, you can make up any sort of rules at all with Calvin Ball. And I just love the fact that in this game between this 7-year-old boy and his imaginary tiger, there's no limits to what they can do. One time you'll see them tagging each other with the volleyball. One time you'll find them running all the way over the hill to spin around 20 times. One time you'll see them zooming into the pond to go swimming for 3 laps. It's an amazing game with no limits. And I think in a real sense, in a very real sense, you can say that the risen Jesus is about having no limits. That the risen Jesus is all about having no limits. The human Jesus, the one that we encounter before Easter Sunday, has limits. He hungers, he thirsts, he is disappointed in his disciples when they don't follow what he is teaching them. He weeps when his friend Lazarus dies. Yet the Jesus who Mary encounters in the garden in John's gospel on Easter Sunday has no limits. Death cannot hold him back. The stone cannot keep him in the tomb. The Romans can't crucify him again. Everything with the risen Jesus is up for grabs. Everything. Because sickness is no more, death is no more, and with Jesus, there are no more limits. And the Easter story is so majestic and so amazing and so holy, everything is up for grabs. It's amazing to me that everything from page 1 of the Bible comes true in a graveyard in Jerusalem. Everything, all the promises that God made to be the people's shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd, Psalm 23. All the promises the Lord made to begin a new covenant where his holy will would be written on our hearts. All of those things, all of those promises in the New Testament, in the Old Testament rather, come true on an Easter Sunday in a graveyard outside of a tomb. Now, I want to look very closely at John chapter 20 because there's a lot of neat little tricks in here. There's a lot of neat little things that if we read too quickly, we will pass over the important parts of the Easter message. First of all, we know that it's Mary Magdalene who goes to the tomb, and she is concerned that Jesus did not have a proper burial. She is concerned that in the bustle and the hecticness of the last 3 days, the horror of Jesus' death as a criminal, that he has not been given a proper burial. He hasn't been anointed, which was common in those days. Instead of embalming, they would anoint the body with spices as a cleansing sort of ritual, as a act of devotion and love. She's probably also concerned that he hasn't been properly wrapped in burial cloths, and so she wants to do something for him that is a sign of love. She wants to make sure that the mocking that he experienced in life does not continue on into his death. She wants to do a favor for him, a favor of love and care and compassion. So she goes early on the first day of the week on Sunday, and she goes down to the graveyard, and she gets there and the stone has been rolled away. And her first thought is to go and tell Simon Peter and the other disciple, who we think is named John, the author of the gospel. She goes to tell Simon Peter and the other disciple that she thinks Jesus' body has been stolen. That the only reason somebody would go into the grave, would take the time to roll the stone away, to go into the grave, would be to look for treasure, would be to look for things that people were buried with. Coins, money, jewels, whatever it was that they had. Maybe even if they were buried with some of their clothes or the death wrappings, perhaps could be sold on the black market. So her first suspicion, without even going into the tomb, without entering the tomb, is that Jesus' body has been stolen. That's the only reason someone would roll back the stone. And she says that to Peter and to John. She says, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. This is yet another terrible thing to happen to Jesus in a long list of terrible things that have happened since Thursday night. Peter and John race over to see for themselves what indeed has happened. They race over to the tomb. They want to investigate. They want to see if Mary can possibly be right. Can this obscene thing have happened to their Lord? Has his body indeed been stolen? They race over to the tomb, and Peter looks into the tomb and sees the strips of linen lying there, but does not go in. Simon Peter goes into the tomb, sees the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. Verse 7, I think, is probably a key to what happens. When Simon Peter goes in, into the tomb, he sees the burial cloth that has been around Jesus' head, and then John tells us this, very interesting. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. I think that's a key. That's a key verse in this story. That the veil over Jesus' head has been folded up neatly. That's the first hint to Simon Peter that Jesus' body has not been stolen. Because what grave robber goes in and then steals the body and then makes sure that the veil that was over the face is nicely folded and put back in place? Nobody does that. They go in, they steal the body, they steal as much as they can, and they run out. Things would be turned all over. They rush in and they rush out. They make a mess and a commotion. So to hear that this veil that was over Jesus' face has been folded up and placed exactly where it should be, put exactly where Jesus' head once was, is a sign. Well, what's the sign? What does it mean? What does a veil do? What's the importance of a veil? A veil over the face does what? A veil normally is to cover something up. It's either to hide something, to hide your eyes. If you're in the Middle East back in Jesus' day, the reason you had a veil was during the great sun of the noonday or during a sandstorm, you could pull it over your face and you could protect your face from the burning of the sun or from the grit and sand of a sandstorm. It was to hide your eyes. Was to hide your face and protect it. So the veil, having been removed from Jesus' face, the veil in the tomb having been removed from his face and folded and put aside, means that Jesus has been uncovered. And we're told that this Jesus who's been uncovered, John saw and believed. This is what the beloved disciple believes. He believes that Jesus has finally been uncovered. It's been uncovered for him who Jesus really is. Jesus being uncovered means that John finally knows, yes, Jesus is the bread of life, that he feeds our souls and that we have eternal life through him. John finally believes that Jesus is the good shepherd. Jesus is the resurrection and the life, or the way, the truth, and the life. John believes now that what has been hidden throughout 19 chapters of the gospel can be seen universally forevermore. If you look back in the Gospel of John, you'll find out that a lot of people see a lot of things, including the disciples, and they're always disbelieving, or maybe disbelieving is too strong of a word, but they always have problems with Jesus. When Jesus feeds the 5,000, people don't get the fact that Jesus is doing this as a miracle, that Jesus is doing this for the benefit of people, and they come to him the next time just because they're hungry and say, hey, could you do that neat trick with the bread again? They don't get that this is about a deeper hunger, a deeper meaning. Over and over and over again, they don't understand who Jesus really is. And John now believes what has been hidden can easily be seen now in faith. And then he runs off. John runs off with Peter, and they run off and they go to their homes. And then we're told that Mary Magdalene is slower in going home. She is standing outside of the tomb, and she encounters the risen Christ. He is standing right before her, the second person of the Trinity, the babe who was born in a stable in Bethlehem. The mystery of the ages is unveiled and revealed. And it's our job as Easter people to describe this unveiling. If there's nothing more that you get out of Easter Sunday, it's important for us to understand this unveiling, to put our thumb on where the risen Jesus is, out and active in this hurting world. That's why I talked to the kids this morning about, even though we can't see Jesus, we know that he loves us and that those stickers are a sign of his love. Because there are no limits. There's no death and destruction. It's our job as Christians to describe this Jesus who has no limits. Now that's easier said than done. Where does the Easter story sit today? It's very hard to tell the Easter story today. It's very difficult to find stories of the dead coming back to life. It's very difficult to find stories where we can talk about the power of the risen Jesus. Or is it? I want to give you an example of what I mean. Since June of 2011, the third civil war in Sudan has been going on. Sudan is a country in northeast Africa, just below Egypt. And there has been a partitioning of Sudan. There's now Sudan and South Sudan. And this has been going on for almost 5 years, people fighting about the difference between Sudan and South Sudan. There are government forces, the army, fighting against guerrilla groups, anti-government forces. In the past 5 years, both sides have bombed civilians and burned buildings. They've taken hostages. The government has said it's important for them to bomb particular places because that's the only way that they can keep their soldiers and citizens safe. But very often, civilians have died, men, women, and children, as collateral damage. And this has been going on, as I said, back and forth for 5 years. And it has caused more than 105,000 refugees to flee their homes in Sudan and South Sudan. There is a camp for refugees, Gendrassa Camp, which now has 17,500 people in it. 17,500 people. Most of these people have made up their mind that they're never going home. They've been there 2 or 3 years, and they have made up their mind that they can't go home, that the security situation is such they'll never go back there. And even if they could, their home would be gone, burned, somebody else would be living in it. And in Sudan culture, it's the head of the tribe or the clan that decides what's important for the community. And many of these heads of tribes have decided that it was safer to move to the Gendrasa camp than to stay home. So when the tribe elder says it's time to go, then everybody packs up and leaves. Sometimes these tribes are only 100 people, small little tribes, some of them. And they came down out of these very rural locations, out of these mountains, in groups of 30, small tribes of 30s, 40s, 50s, 100s. And these are refugees who just left with whatever they could because they were afraid they were going to get killed if they stayed. Just recently, in the past couple months, there has been an influx of these tribal members who have sought out Christian missionaries. And they've said to them, "Hey, could you tell us who this Jesus is that you're always talking about? And tell us something." And the missionaries have said, "What? What do you want to know?" And they said, "How come you welcomed us?" You see, what the missionaries did is they saw when the people were coming into the camps that they left with nothing or almost nothing. And that when they came into the camps, the missionaries saw to it that they had fresh, clean water and saw that they had enough rice and saw that they maybe had a few things to begin their new house over again, their new household. And in Sudan, that's not what you do. If a stranger comes to you, you don't welcome them unless they're part of the same ethnic group or the same religious group or some sort of kin group. A stranger from another group is just a stranger. Let somebody else worry about that. And so these folks who've come down out of the mountains said to these Christian missionaries, "Why did you welcome us? Why did you accept us and give us something? We can't give you back anything. We don't have anything to give you." And the missionaries say something like, "Well, Jesus tells us we have to welcome the poor and the stranger, that it's our job to take care of our neighbor, that we have to love our neighbors as ourselves." And gradually, these folks are inquiring who this Jesus is. Where does he live? Where does Jesus live? What culture is he from? What country? Where is he from? And gradually, they're told this story of this risen Jesus who's out in the world, who has no limits, who's breaking down every barrier. And sometimes the story is told one-on-one. Sometimes some of the refugees will bring a couple of their friends, three or four or five. And those three or four or five will then go back and then they will tell the tribal elder, "You've got to hear about this person, Jesus." These are folks that have never met a Christian before because they were so isolated up in the mountains of Sudan. They've never seen a Christian church. They don't know what a cross around the neck or on the altar might mean. And so they go to the tribal elder and they come and they say to the tribal elder, "Would you like to hear about Jesus?" And of course, as I told you earlier, if the tribal elder says yes, well, then all 50 of them come down to the missionary and hear the story of Jesus with no limits. That's what I mean about Jesus being out and around in the world. That's what I mean about not being able to put Jesus in a box, because only the risen Christ can fix bitterness and regret. Only the risen Christ can heal refugees who have left with nothing on their backs. Only the risen Christ can heal your imprisonment or your addiction or your depression. Wherever the veil is lifted, Jesus Christ is truly free, and there is no limit to him. And that's a great message for Easter Sunday and every Sunday. Christ is risen. Christ is risen indeed. Amen.